And then we said, oh, we can take the variation, split it into a source term and a boundary term. Then the source term gives us the equations of motion, which define the Euler-Lagrange locus, or the shell, which is the subspace of field space, such that which solves the equations of motion. So these are the dynamical histories, if you want. So I call iota L the embedding of the space of solutions of the equations of motion in the space of all possible configurations. I want to an important remark is that whereas this space is a space of local fields, so sections of some fiber bundle, this is not. So for example, here I can apply the Stakem's theorem, which is about the uniqueness of this kind of decompositions. Here I cannot, because this is not local. So I haven't maybe emphasized that enough. This is important if you're trying to use the theorem for certain proofs. In the lecture notes, I emphasize this when it's important, but in the class, I will not say much more than this.
Okay, yeah. Is what you lose uniqueness, or do you actually lose
It's a theorem that makes sense on the space of local forms.
Yeah.
It's just, I wouldn't know, what. Yeah. Sometimes this space is isomorphic to another local space. So for example, you could say, oh, I can identify the space of solution with the space of configuration on a certain surface, and this space of configuration on the surface happens to be describable locally on that hypersurface. But this doesn't always happen. In gauge theories, it does not happen. And it's not anymore on M. A space on M would be a space on sections on sigma, because it's the space of initial conditions at that point. So it's possible to have some turnaround way of redescribing this in a local way, but at this level, it's not, and it doesn't. Good. Next, we use this ingredient. Now we use this other ingredient to define the symplectic form current. So we have a covariant symplectic potential current because it's a top minus one form. And by deriving it, taking the differential field space, we have the symplectic form current. So again, this is not symplectic in any sense. It's a mixed space-time and field space form. So already that's not good, but this we can fix by integrating it. So this is now a two form on field space. But it's highly degenerate, in fact. So that there's no sense in which this is symplectic whatsoever. To make things a little better, we go on shell. So what happens when we go on shell? The symplectic current is conserved. And if we have a Cauchy surface, a proper Cauchy surface, so M is sigma cross R, and sigma has no boundaries, what one finds is that omega sigma on the space of pulled back to the space of solutions of the equations of motion is in fact independent on the choice of sigma. So I can pick some d sigma, as long as it's space-like, it doesn't really matter, okay? So in this sense, now I can think of the space of solutions together with this on-shell two-form, and this is a good candidate now for a phase space. And we saw that in simple examples, like the particle, the scalar field, this is indeed the case. This is isomorphic to the canonical phase space. However, we do not have a theorem yet. And in fact, in gauge theories, again, this does not work. We have to work a little bit harder to make this proposal concrete and, in fact, a bit more rigorous. But the important point is that this is going in the right direction because it's a completely covariant way of thinking about the phase space when it works. When it doesn't work, it just means we have to work a bit harder to make it work. Good. Finally, we said, But wait, here we did everything, but there are not yet symmetries. We want to understand symmetries. So what is the right notion of symmetries here? Well, we started from a Lagrangian. Therefore, what we want is a notion of Lagrangian symmetry. What is the right notion is we want a symmetry such that the variation of the Lagrangian along that symmetry is a boundary term. So this is a standard requirement. And so it's a bit weaker than saying it is completely invariant. For example, when you have diffeomorphic symmetry, you get these boundary terms. But even with simpler symmetries, as we will see later. Then we defined the Noether current as this combination of theta contracted with the symmetry and R, this boundary term. And it's a simple exercise to prove that this current is conserved on shell. Now, there are, and this is Noether first theorem. And I think this is where we stopped. The next step is to go a bit farther and try to understand when symmetries. So we show that whenever we have a symmetry, there is a conserved charge. Well, the conserved charge, of course, is, let's say sigma is again boundaryless, then Q sigma, the integral of J, is a conserved charge, is independent of sigma. So this is our notion of conserved charge. If sigma has boundaries, so we are in a situation where the charge can leak outside through the time-like boundary. Sometimes that's called the flux, but it's just a refined notion of the same conservation laws, local conservation law. Okay, now we want to understand put together these ideas and the symplectic picture and try to see if the symmetries sometimes are, if these are generators of our symmetries. And although you would expect that this is always the case, the answer is not. This is not always the case. So let's start working on this. First, I want to mention, ask if there are any questions, and then mention a basic fact that I forgot to talk about last time. Questions? No? Yeah?
Maybe one quick one. What's the intuition of defining the current like that again?
It's the one that that works. I'm combining this boundary term here with this boundary term appearing here essentially. Okay. So it's two ways of computing the variation of the Lagrangian along a symmetry. One is off shell. You just say off shell this is true. You just go and plug in the variation and just do whatever you have to do and see if it's invariant or not. There instead, you do it it seems that you're doing the same computation, right? Because you are,
yeah.
Of course, it's easier in examples to understand that this is a non-trivial statement. But the point is that you can repackage this term to be proportional to the equations of motion. It's an identity, so this does not contain this plus that equal to zero is a completely trivial statement, but the point is that here I've put in evidence the equations of motion, and therefore this becomes non-true. Okay. So this is off-shell. So the crucial thing is that this is an off-shell state. Okay, the basic fact that I haven't mentioned, because it's somewhat obvious, but in fact it's a bit harder to prove than I would expect, and in fact I will not prove it here, it's in the notes, is the fact that, I'll say it in two ways. Rho psi, rho is a Lagrangian symmetry, I will not write it every single time. Rho psi is tangent to to the space of solutions in F. Say it otherwise, the equations of motion are on shell invariant under symmetries. So what this is saying is that if you have a solution and you apply a symmetry, you get another solution, which is kind of obvious, but in fact is harder to prove than this Noether theorem. So it's not much harder, but it would it's a bit more technical. So symmetries preserve, well, I will not try to write it in words, unless there are questions about it. Okay, good. So now let's start by exploring the next question about generators. By looking at what I will call the best case scenario. So if I can set R to zero and find a symplectic potential such that its lead derivative along the symmetry is zero. So notice that this is a lead derivative of a one form. So I'm, so this has to be taken appropriately into account when doing the computation. But if this is the case, then I have a sufficient condition for the following equation to hold. And again, the proof is a one-liner because it just write this, it's again looks like a trick. I write this with Cartan's formula. One term is the contraction of rho with delta theta, which is my left-hand side. And the second term is delta, the contraction of rho with theta, which is my right-hand side, because I've set R to zero. So this looks, again, like a trick, but let's see that it's not an empty statement. So an example, again, let's use the particle. I have it somewhere. So for the particle, remember that my field space is the space of maps from M is equal to R. So this is a one-dimensional field theory where the only dimension is time. So M is equal to R cross one point. And configuration space, well, the target space of my fields is R3. So field space is the space of functions from R, which is time, or M, I should maybe write M, to R3. In this case, well, the Lagrangian is the usual one. And theta is m q dot dq. So what is peculiar here, I said it last time, I repeat it, is that this is a field, right? It's a field depending on time. And these are variations of the field. It's not a dq, the usual finite dimensional dq. This is really a variation in this functional space. Now, it doesn't really matter whether I put theta or theta underlined because sigma is a point. So there's no need to differentiate between the two. Then I take G to be rotations. And let's see that rock psi is then epsilon ijk psi j d over dq k. Okay? So this is true at every single time. So psi is constant in time, whereas this is a well, maybe I should have. So this is an integral in time of this. Okay, I should write it like this. I should correct it. So this is an integral over time of this, which means that every qt at every single time is rotated by the same amount. Now, clearly, this is invariant under that symmetry, right? Because this is a dot product. The delta doesn't really care about the psi, the rotation. So this will be invariant. So this is quite intuitive because I multiply, let's say, instead of doing the infinitesimal version, I do the finite version and multiply by rotation matrix here. I have the transpose on the other side, but the rotation is not field dependent, it's just a parameter. So this comes across, it simplifies, and there's not very much to prove. If I didn't know and I wanted to check it explicitly, the way to do it is to write these in components. And take the variation of these, so write this piece inside here instead, and then take the variation, write the, what is strange here? Oh, I forgot the Q, sorry. I, Q, T, J, D, D, Q, T, K. So replace these here, plus the variation of that. So you have to take the variation of every single q, since the lead derivative goes across the differential. It's just you take the variation of every single appearance of q independently, sum them all, and you will find zero, because this is antisymmetric and so on and so forth. But the finite rotation argument is much simpler, so I will stick to that. And this is the case. So I know at that point that J of psi will be I rock psi theta. And so now instead is a contraction, not a lead derivative. So I'm just replacing the delta variation with the value of the vector. So this is m q dot I delta psi qi. And this is, of course, so psi I, so this becomes a k, and q, qj. And this is, of course, angular momentum. So in this sense, this looks an empty statement, but in fact, it has a content. So then I can compute this explicitly if I wanted to, but that would be obvious at this point. Yeah.
Setting the requirement that R of Z should be 0 is too restrictive, I think, because all we need is that the exterior derivative of R is 0. We don't need R to be 0.
Yeah, but true. Fine. It's uh, Okay, it's but requiring that, it means that this is field independent. And I would argue that is pretty rare that you do a transformation here, since this is a functional of the fields, and you check whether it's invariant or not, and it happens not to be invariant only up to something that does not depend on your field. So I would say, in practice, the two conditions are pretty much the same. Yeah, just knowing where this is coming from, I don't think that generalizing really adds much. So here we are saying, if the Lagrangian itself is strictly speaking invariant under the symmetry, then, and we can find a potential which is also invariant under the symmetry, then we are done. We know what the current is, and we know that it is a we call this then a covariant symmetry generator. So I should have written it. Then covariant symmetry generator. Okay, and of course, if I integrate this on sigma, pull it back on my phase space, then all these operations become rather trivial, and we find that on the candidate phase space, the equation it would expect to hold does hold, because then pulling back these things, integrating it over sigma, and pulling it back to the space of solutions are kind of are trivial operations from the point of view of this equation, right? You just do it. It's not going to change the form. You just put sigmas here and a wiggle, and you're done. So going on shell, it's at this point is simple. But what we want to understand is how general this state of affairs is. And the answer, unfortunately, is a bit unsatisfactory. I will not be able to give you a sharp statement that tells you if this and that happens, then you're sure that this is going to work. You sort of have to check it. But I want to still give a sense of what is what to expect. So so let's say, so there is a simple lemma, which is really a game of reshuffling things around, which is the following. Under the usual hypothesis, rho is a Lagrangian symmetry of L. Then what happens? Then we have this identity. I just call arc psi whatever is left, and the remainder, and this is this can be shown to be equal to the following. It's more like an observation. This is a trivial, if you plug this in, it's really a trivial identity. I'm just, you see, computing this, which is what worked in the previous lemma, but now it's non-zero. Then I have to, this is what gives me, to get J, I need to add delta R, and I add it and subtract it, and this is what I find. So it's not a super interesting statement like this, but at least it tells me what the reminder is. And so it's obvious that if this is zero and this is zero, as Vatsalia was saying, then it would work. But it could happen that the two, in fact, what usually happens is that the two compensate or something. It's not necessarily, they don't have to vanish independently. Now, to better understand what is this guy, one can, there is another way to obtain these, and which is the following. Where did I put it? Sorry. Actually, let me just be a bit. It's an unsatisfactory way of phrasing things, but let's just give a few scenarios of what could happen, and then I will come back to this expression. So what could happen is that first let's try to give some off-shell statement. So off-shell, what could happen is that either arcxi is zero, like in the best case scenario situation, or another interesting thing that could happen is that arcxi is not zero, but is a pure boundary term. And in this case, I also, since at the end of the day, what I'm really interested in is the phase space over sigma. If this is a boundary term and I'm integrating over a sigma without boundaries, then this term will drop as well. So if either one then what I obtain is that I rho xi omega sigma is off shell equal to dq. Sorry. So these are criteria. It's not extremely insightful, but it's good, I think, to have a sense of what the scenarios could be. And then I will give examples of some of these scenarios. If either, and here, what could, I can just say the same thing, but on shell. So on shell, what can happen is that this is not really zero, but is zero on shell. Or is only on shell, it becomes a boundary term. Then the same thing is true on shell. So in fact, at the end of the day, we care, both are important. In particular, it could happen that we do not have a good off-shell statement, but we do have a good on-shell one. This is what happens in gravity. So gravity and certain diffeomorphisms will be the case two. So there are concrete examples of this, and even one which is simpler, which I will discuss in a second. Best case scenario is this one. So let's say, just to give a sense of where things fall, this is best case scenario. And this is let's say time translations in a scalar field theory, which I will discuss today, or what we will discuss later is is essentially diffeos which are transverse to sigma, which I will call time diffeos in GR. But in general, it's better to think of, to say that diffeomorphisms have some issues. So this is why I'm giving this zoology, because the two interesting cases are the most interesting one are the two extremes, but there are some intermediate cases that could happen in principle. So we gave an example of the best case scenario. Let's give an example of the, well, I wouldn't call it worst case scenario because things still work in some sense, but they're just not as simple as they. It could also happen that this is just not zero, doesn't go away in any way, even on shell, and then there is an actual obstruction, right? So these are all good situations, in a sense. So let's do a scalar example, scalar field. With time translation symmetry. The details of the calculations are given in the notes. So I will go a bit fast, otherwise we'll take forever. So we start with L, which is this Lagrangian. And our symmetry in fact, I will work it with the tensor notation, not the form one. So this is the scalar Lagrangian. It's multiplied by this square root of G, which I'm not introducing, but is there. So we are on a manifold. And let's suppose that this manifold has some Killing symmetry. So chi is a Killing vector field. So in particular, we have L chi GAB equal D chi B plus DB chi A, which is zero. And we want to understand the denoter theorem for this symmetry. So if you are on Minkowski, these are the Poincaré transformations, right? In particular, time translation will be one of them. But it's nicer to work geometrically in a more general case instead of looking at every single example. So what happens in this case is that theta A is dA phi d phi. Not too hard to see. I'm just is the boundary term that I get when I integrate by parts with the delta. RA chi is chi A, well, 1/2, sorry, well, it's 1/2 L, in fact. So this is, no, sorry, is chi A times L, which we will see that this is what usually, what happens always with diffeomorphism. This is like a diffeomorphic symmetry, except that is a very special diffeomorphism, which is a Killing. But okay. So these are theta and r, which I can just compute explicitly. And the computation is done in the notes. Once I do that, I can also deduce what J is. And J is not surprising, is the generator of this translation. So it will be chi contracted with with the stress energy tensor, right? So these will be here. dA phi dB phi minus 1/2 delta AB dC phi dC phi. So far nothing is surprising, but what happens if I compute little r, which is the obstruction? So I can, of course, compute it directly using this formula, or rather trying to check if this is correct. You do it as you wish. But if you compute this, what you find is the following. So, what do we learn? We learn that we have, so let's start from the second term. So this is SAB. So you see it's antisymmetric. So it is the tensorial version of a top minus 2 form. So I'm Hodge-dualizing and raising the indices, essentially. But it stays antisymmetric. And it's a total derivative of this. So it's precisely this term over here. And it comes out antisymmetric on its own. So this is, we have a corner term. And the bulk term, on the other hand, well, I haven't written them, but the equations of motion of that Lagrangian, you know them. So they're proportional to the equations of motion over here. So we are precisely in case 2-2. And what is interesting is, OK, all of this is good. What happens if I integrate things over sigma? So here, there could be one more case, which I haven't written, but it's. We find the following thing. So what is the obstruction on a boundary-less sigma? Of course, if there is a boundary, we know that we have this. So that's easy. But let's focus on this term for a second. So R sigma becomes the integral of sigma of, so this is a current, right? So to integrate it over sigma, it means that I have to contract it with the normal. So we have the square root of the induced metric, Na, which, well, let's call it H, Na chi A box phi d phi. What do we learn? We learn that we only, so have issues. So if sigma, suppose we are in Rn, in R3, and I've taken the obvious foliation, no, by time constant slices, and these are spatial translations along the slices, this term will not be there. So this problem arises when chi is transverse to the sigma I've chosen. So this is non-zero only if in this sense here I have put into evidence time. So there is this situation where, conversely, if we have chosen a foliation and translations along this foliation, it looks like we have an obstruction here. But in fact, it gives no problem once we integrate. So we do get this type of equation for spatial translations, but we don't for time translations. Is this, but we go on shell and everything gets fixed. Is this surprising? Maybe not so much in the sense that time translation symmetry is clearly related to dynamics. We saw this when we studied the parameterized particle in particular, how to kind of think about dynamical evolution as a Hamiltonian evolution, but in fact it works only if things are time independent. Otherwise you have to work in this bigger framework that we developed in the tutorial. And so in reality, we know that time evolution is a Hamiltonian symmetry in the usual sense only if we have time translation invariants. So it maybe in this case it's not too surprising, but the very same result we will find it for GR, where it is a bit more surprising because these are global symmetries of our scalar field, whereas for GR's diffuse are gauge symmetries. So having this type of obstructions for a gauge symmetry, it feels a bit more severe. Whereas here we can live with it by telling ourselves, oh, this is about time evolution, it's changing foliation, and therefore it's natural that it has to know about the dynamics for this to work. So you can tell yourself a story that makes sense of these results on physical grounds. Yeah? So this is a teaser for what's coming in GR, in fact. So I will not say, in fact, I was thinking of saying something more about this R, but I don't think I will. So let me just say that this fact that the bulk term of the obstruction, it is, I don't know cases where it's not proportional to the equations of motion. Let me just say it like this. So I don't know if that's, but I couldn't find an argument, and I don't think there is an argument, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I couldn't find an argument that would prove it. You can get pretty close to proving it, but there is a small detail that is annoying, that there is some cohomological issue, so you could find some weird cohomological obstructions to for it to work. But morally speaking, I would say you should expect this type of the case 2-2 to be quite generic. You should at least be in this situation. If you find something that doesn't respect 2-2, let me know. Yeah, I would be very interested. Yes.
If we don't go on shell, then the exterior derivative of J is not necessarily zero, and we don't necessarily have a charge on the boundary. Then I don't understand the first statement where we are off shell getting this relation between 2-form and Q.
If K is 1-1?
Any of the, like 1-1 or 1-2, even the existence of the charge Q is not guaranteed if we are.
Oh, I'm not saying this is conserved off shell. It's not the statement. I'm stating that this equation holds.
For some sigma.
Yeah, in fact, for any choice of sigma. Mm-hmm. They do not talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So statement on different sigmas do not talk to each other because you're not imposing the equations of motion that allows you to go from one sigma to the other, but for each choice of sigma, this holds. In fact, when you do, you can think of, when you do the phase space of electromagnetism, for example, and you work with DNA and you consider them independent and so on, and you put no you don't impose the Gauss constraint, you're working off shell. And when you say that gauge transformations are generated by the Gauss constraint, but you're not yet imposing the Gauss constraint, you're in 1-1, in fact, in that case. So you might compute your charge on different sigmas. It is garbage in the sense that they're all unrelated. They can take whichever value they want because you're off shell. But as a statement, it works. And in fact, working off shell can be quite useful because the phase space structure is so simple that you know how to quantize it. And then you worry about imposing the Gauss constraint quantum mechanically later on, maybe. So that's why off shell statements are important, because they are easier to quantize, if you want. So whereas on-shell things can be harder. There are techniques for anything, but it just gets hard. Yeah. So in a way, what you would use maybe BRST off-shell, you have to use BV on-shell, but a little bit. So it's a more complicated framework. It's just as a teaser. Okay, so I think this discovers it. So far we have concluded the discussion of global of Noether 1 and its relation to symmetry generators. The next step is to focus on the case of local symmetries. Any questions so far? So of course, Noether 1,
I'm going to make a statement about global symmetries in this
case. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I was about to say. So far, we never used that the symmetries must be global. Those statements hold even if the symmetries are local. But we will see that their interpretation has to be changed a bit in the case of local symmetry. So now we are specializing what we found to a case where it sounds more general, but in a way it's more specific, in the sense that if you think, so maybe this is an important conceptual point. It might sound like gauge symmetries generalize global symmetries. And so statement that you find for global symmetries go through for gauge symmetries, which in a sense is correct. But on the other hand, physically speaking, you could say, well, it's well, maybe I'm getting. But in a sense, they really have. There is like an important change between the two. That's all I want to say. It's not putting parameters, setting the parameters to be constant instead of point dependent is not the right way of thinking about globalizing a symmetry. Let me just leave it at this, and I will try to be more specific in examples. So one example is diffeomorphism. The right way to talk about global symmetries is to pick killing symmetry, so they have special properties with respect to some structure that you have. It's not a constant diffeomorphism. The notion of constant is ill-defined when you have to give some geometric condition, and this is true also in Young Mills. So a constant gauge transformation in Young Mills is not a global symmetry. Okay, that's what I want to point out. So notion between global and local can be subtle, the passage between one to the other. Okay, so I'm not sure how far I will be able to go today, but
global symmetries are those that in some sense preserve your background structure.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so what is a local symmetry? Well, a local symmetry is a specific case where my Lie algebra is itself point dependent on space. So I will change letter. This is a capital frac G. So in this section, I will use G as, so results so far hold also for local symmetry. In this section, we change notation. So we keep G is a finite dimensional semi-simple, doesn't really matter, it's a semi-simple Lie algebra. You can think of either R or SU2. For our, as far as we are concerned, they are the only two examples that we look at. Well, R is not semi-simple because it's abelian, but it's easy enough to deal with. And G is, again, this could be generalized, but I don't really care. We wouldn't gain anything, so we'll just leave it like this. They are functions from space-time into my finite dimensional Lie algebra. So this becomes now my Lie algebra of symmetries. So nothing too surprising. And what is the bracket here? So if we have psi and eta in G, we define the brackets of psi and eta at x as the bracket of these two at x. So not very original, right? So we do this all the time. We don't even think about it. But this at least gives us a, so technically this is a Lie algebra in G, and this is the old Lie algebra bracket. So what we do, so to have the results hold in this section, of course, everywhere little g should be replaced by big G. If I want to translate neuter 1 to this case, but the notation with psi just remains the same. So if you just plug in xi, which depends on x there, everything is all right. So now recall neuter 1, which told us, so usually one says, oh, this is conserved on shell. But now I want to focus on the off-shell part of the statement. Oops. So now we can ask, what kind of structure will this guy have? I will write it like this, and so this will be some okay, so I will give examples so it will be clear. So this is a sum phi dependent differential operator. In examples, it's clear what I mean, right? So if I have dxi of, so let's say Young-Mills, in Young-Mills dxi of A will be dxi plus AA psi. Or if we want, using indices, this is delta alpha beta dA plus F alpha beta gamma A beta, oops, maybe I put a gamma here, psi gamma. So this is this D, okay? Alpha. So this big I here, it's about this index. So it just that is it clear what I mean here? So this will be just some differential operator. It could be have terms proportional to xi, terms that depend on derivative of xi, and so on. But it's linear in psi because it's an infinitesimal symmetry. So that we know, and that's why we write it like this. Now, let me just phrase.
Should we think of this dxi of A as like covariant derivative?
Dxi. Well, in this case, it's the usual covariant derivative. At A, so it's dependent on the field. So in gravity, this would be this forgetting that this is equal to zero, you would get this kind of combination. So it's some combination of covariant derivatives. It will have to, if there are derivatives, it will have to be covariant. So yes, you can expect this to be some sort of combination of covariant derivatives. I know I'm running over time. I just want to state at this point the second Noether theorem, but before I need one ingredient. So suppose xi is of let's do it like this. Let's say that sigma has no no boundaries. Then I integrate over sigma d alpha I psi, and this by integration by part must be let's see where the indices go. So there is some other operator which is the adjoint operator acting on E now. So this is called the adjoint operator. But it's an integration by parts. So if you think of this in any specific example, you're just integrating by parts things. So in this case, this guy would probably be minus the same operator, but it doesn't need to be. It can change if signs are complicated. You know, when integrated by parts, you could get something slightly different. And now the statement is, this is Noether 2. The statement is that this guy must vanish. And I leave it, I will do the proof next time. So it means that not all the equations of motion are independent, and there is a lot to say about it, but I have to stop. Thanks.